what the, and corresponding MP3 for this number, I don't seem to have an order. I think it's August 9th. Okay, so we're ready to move to chapter 11. Ready?
Thank you.
Yep.
So part two of the book. Part one is insight as activity. It's the phenomenology, really. It is a phenomenology of the operations of insight and judgment. Fred Crowe has a recent article called For a Phenomenology of Rational Consciousness, based on a comment that Lonergan made that the phenomenologists, the classical phenomenologists, Husserl and those who followed them, never quite got to the point of doing a phenomenology of judgment. And this is what Lonergan is attempting to offer in the chapters on judgment and reflective understanding. But really, the first 10 chapters of the book are a phenomenology of cognitional process, insight as activity. Now the question comes along about insight as knowledge. What am I doing when I am knowing? Part two is entitled Insight as Knowledge. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that knowing? Why isn't it something else? Why isn't it thinking? Why isn't it mind games? Why isn't it conceptualizing? Why isn't it fantasizing? Why is it knowing? And what do I know when I do that? All right. So chapters 1 to 11 basically are answering this question, but the answer doesn't come until chapter 11. What am I doing when I'm knowing? And the judgment that is made in chapter 11 really responds to that. Why is doing that knowing? Chapters 12 and 13, being and objectivity. What do I know when I do that? Chapters 14 to 17 on metaphysics. And then there's another question. What do I do when I know all that? What do I do when I've answered these questions? And that's the question for the Lonergan community to answer, because it involves the reorientation and the integration of contemporary knowledge, the sciences, the human sciences, theology, and so on. But anyway, these are the three basic questions. What am I doing when I'm knowing? Why is doing that knowing? And what do I know when I do that? So this is what we're interested in today. This brings, chapter 11 brings to a conclusion the study of that first question. And so we begin in part two with the act of making a judgment. And this is really the first judgment that he asks you to make. The rest of it is just follow along the phenomenology. You can raise a lot of questions, and you can, you know, obviously you've made judgments as you go along, but he hasn't asked you to make any judgments yet. He's just asked you to think along with him. And in chapter 11, he wants you to make a correct judgment. And it is the judgment, I am a knower, the self-affirmation of the knower. It's a judgment that affirms one instance, namely your own, of this whole process that he's been outlining up to this point, precisely as a cognitional process. This is what I do when I'm engaged in acts of knowing. The self-affirmation of the knower. I am a knower. The self in question is you. The concrete and intelligible unity identity whole that I am. Someone asked Lonergan once, when you're talking about authenticity, are you talking about blah, 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 blah? And he said, I'm talking about you. So the self in question is you. In a self-affirmation, I am both affirmer and affirmed. I'm affirming myself. And in a self-affirmation of the knower, I affirm myself as characterized by such occurrences as sensing, perceiving, imagining, inquiring, understanding, formulating, reflecting, grasping, the unconditioned, and affirming. These things go on in me. I do these things. they don't just go on in me the way the metabolism of my cells goes on in me without my having much control over it, except that I take care of my health, but otherwise it sort of goes on its own. No, I do these. I sense, I perceive, I imagine, I inquire, I understand, I formulate, I reflect, I grasp the unconditioned, I affirm. So the affirmation that he's asking you to make is a judgment of fact. It's not a judgment of necessity. It's not like, I necessarily exist and necessarily am an intelligent and rational person. No, it's just that this is, I do these things, that's all. In fact, I exist, not necessarily. And in fact, I'm a knower, not necessarily. In fact, I perform these operations, and by knowing, I mean no more than such performance. At this point. At this point, he's not saying, I know something. What I know being, not saying anything like that. It's just that by knowing, up to this point, all he means is I perform these operations. Not yet a question of what do I know when I do it. It's just these things go on in me, that's all. Okay, so he's not asking you to affirm anything else. He's not asking you to affirm realism. He's not asking you to affirm you know the real world. He's just asking you to affirm these operations are things that I do. The judgment is a virtually unconditioned, or a contingently unconditioned. In other words, you can grasp sufficient evidence for making this particular judgment. So he claims, the link between the conditioned I am a knower and its conditions may be cast in a proposition. I'm a knower if I am a concrete, intelligible unity, identity, whole, characterized by acts of sensing, perceiving, and so on and so forth. But that's not what the process that he brings you through to answer, to get to that point. Because the fulfillment of the conditions is not given in a logical, as it's not a logical conclusion based on propositions, but rather he's saying the fulfillment of those conditions is given in consciousness. So we can find, we can locate the operations that he's talking about in consciousness, in the data of consciousness. So if there's any problem with making the judgment, it's this fulfillment of the conditions in consciousness. So that's what he spends the first part of the chapter on. The notion of consciousness in Lonergan. Consciousness is not knowledge. I can be conscious and ignorant. I can be conscious and in error. I can be conscious and wrong. I can be conscious and not knowing. I can consciously say, I don't know. So consciousness is not knowledge. Nor is it some kind of inward look. That I'm only conscious when I'm looking inside. No. The conception of consciousness as an inward look is based on the conception that consciousness is some form of knowing, and that knowing is a matter of taking a look. Consciousness is obviously not looking out, so it must be looking in, and that's just a myth. The whole thing's a myth. Consciousness is not the same as knowing, and knowing is not taking a look. So consciousness is not some inward look, so that I'm only conscious when I'm introspective, looking in. No. Consciousness is rather an awareness immanent in certain activities, including cognitional acts. Not only in cognitional acts, it's also imminent in feelings, for instance. It's imminent in dreams. It's imminent in prayer. It's imminent in the heights of mystical prayer. A lot of mystics are not unconscious. Right? But it's also imminent in cognitional acts. These acts differ radically from such unconscious acts as the metabolism of one's cells, which only becomes conscious if something really goes wrong with them, when pain comes into consciousness. The maintenance of one's organs, that just goes ahead. The multitudinous biological processes that one learns about through the study of contemporary medical science. And the difference is that cognitional acts, or if you want, feelings, dreams, prayer, and so on, occur within consciousness. That's the difference between all of those things and the metabolism of my cells, the maintenance of bodily organisms, and so on. In his work shortly after Insight, in order to get at the notion of consciousness, Lonergan spoke about three kinds of presence. So this is not in Insight, these three kinds of presence. The table is present in the room. That's a physical presence. You are present to me. It's a different kind of presence. It's a psychological presence. You are present to me. But you couldn't be present to me in that way unless I am present to myself. And it's only because I'm present to myself that you can be present to me in a psychological sense, not just in a physical sense. Okay? The chairs are present to each other in a physical sense, but that chair is not aware of the other one. But you're present to me in a sense in which I'm aware of you. But you couldn't be present to me unless I were first of all present to myself. This is consciousness. Self-presence. That's consciousness. Animals are conscious in the same way. I mean, they don't have all the same activities that we do, but they have that self-presence. So that I'm present to that cat that I play with every day, okay? Because the cat is present to itself. There's a certain consciousness there, so I can be present to the cat. Another way in which he makes it clear what he means by consciousness is in what was first of all a Latin treatise of the Gregorian, De Constitutione Christi Psychologica and Ontologica and Psychologica. The ontological and psychological constitution of Christ. It's now a collected works in volume 7. And we've got the Latin and English facing pages. But he distinguishes a notion of consciousness as perception, conscientia, percepcia, which is a counterposition. It's an error. That consciousness is some kind of perception. It's like, again, taking a good look, but taking a good look within. Many, many people have this conception that consciousness is perception. And for Lonergan, he contrasts conscientia perceptio to his own position, which is conscientia experientia. Consciousness is simply experience, awareness. It's not perception. You can be conscious and have your eyes closed and you're not perceiving anything. But you're experiencing. Because you're present to yourself. This has an awful lot to do with the very complicated questions of the consciousness and knowledge of Christ. Who is conscious? So many of the treatments, I don't want to get into the dogmatic issue here, but so many of the treatments of the consciousness of Christ have something to do with the human consciousness perceiving the divinity. And he said that's completely the wrong way to raise the question. Who's conscious and how is the right way to perceive it? Well, who is conscious? The incarnate Word of God. And the incarnate Word of God experiences in two ways, divinely and human. Experientia divina, experientia humana. There's two consciousnesses. And then the issue is how do you get them related to one another? That's a major systematic theological question. But the dogmatic question is who's conscious and how? And it's the incarnate Word. The person is conscious with the divine consciousness and the human consciousness. It's not an issue of one of them perceiving God. But anyway, that's a whole other dogmatic issue. But you can see that this plays out into an understanding of dogmatic matters in theology.
Excuse me, Bob, I'm going to ask you just to say that one more time. In De Constitutione Christi, the who it is the consciousness of the Word of God.
The question is not a matter of the human nature of Jesus perceiving God, perceiving the divine nature. That's conscientia perceptio. Okay. The question is, who's conscious in this person and how? And it's the incarnate Word of God is the person who is conscious. with the divine and with the human consciousness. With two consciousnesses. There are two consciousnesses because there are two operations. Dogmatically, in Christ, there are two operations and two wills. Those are dogmas. Lonergan starts with the dogmatic as truth, and then he tries to understand it. So he starts with that. The church has defined that there are two sets of operations and two wills. So there have got to be two consciousnesses if that's the case, because willing is conscious activity. So there have got to be two. You've got two. The whole question is how do you get them together? But you start with the issue of who is conscious. That's the question. Just as with you, you know, who's conscious? You are conscious. How? With a human self-presence. Jesus is conscious with a divine self-presence and a human self-presence, and they are cooperating with one another. They interact with each other. So. And he's unique. No one else has that consciousness. So it influences a lot of different questions about is the beatific vision and everything else. The beatific vision is elemental in Jesus. It's elemental at the level of the divine self-presence. So it's powerful stuff. It cuts through a lot. But anyway, I just want to show that this is why he introduces the distinction in De Constitutione Christi. And it's another way of talking about what consciousness is. Consciousness is simply experience. That's all. Okay. So by a conscious act then, number five, is not meant a deliberate act. So I don't have to make up my mind. One instance of it would be that you're conscious when you're dreaming. You couldn't remember any dreams if you weren't. It's a minimal consciousness, but it's still there. It's not a deliberate act. Nor is it an act to which one attends. Nor is it an act somehow isolated for inspection or grasped in its function or assigned a name, etc. That's later. You can assign it a name later. A lot of times we don't know what it is that we're conscious of, that we're feeling, for instance. It takes a long time sometimes. Feelings can be so complicated that for us to name them can be a long process, but they're conscious before they're named. One cannot deny that within the cognitional act, and that's what he's concerned with here, the cognitional act, as it occurs, there is a factor or element or component over and above its content, and that this factor is what differentiates cognitional acts from unconscious occurrences. It's that factor, it's that awareness, that experience that is imminent in certain activities that is not present in other activities. When I'm sleeping in a dreamless sleep, I'm unconscious. Right? And that, what's the difference between that? That there's an awareness otherwise that is not present when I'm in a dreamless sleep. That awareness is consciousness. So that's the notion of consciousness. Now, do you have a question?
I'm a bit confused by this phrase where you're saying that the conscious act is not an act to which one attends. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, if something is conscious,
right.
Okay, by virtue of it being an experience, you are attending to the experience.
Not necessarily, because you can be. You can not even know until afterwards, you know. It depends on what you mean by attending. But by attending here, he means taking a stance with regard to, paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. Let's an example could be. I mean, I think that people who are constantly attending to their conscious activities can get awfully wrapped up in introspection and so on. You know, and then when you're just enjoying an evening with friends, you know, you don't stop and reflect on it every 5 minutes and just say, "Am I really having a good time?" You just go ahead and do it.
Depends on the company.
You know what I mean. You just do it, and then you attend to it. Later.
That gets me in trouble.
So that is what.
Well, that's why, you know, that maybe is another example.
No, I guess what I meant, you are right. It depends what you mean by attention.
That's
because what I meant by attention is just the process of intending
to an item of consciousness. I mean, attending to this pen because I'm seeing it.
In that sense, yeah, they're attending. I mean, the imperative for experience is to be attentive. So in that sense, but when your senses are alive, you are being attentive, but you're not necessarily attending to your attentiveness at the same time.
So that is what you mean here.
That's what it means here. It's not, there's no reflexive activity involved. That's the second step, to be reflexive about it. So you can be attending to the pen or attending to whatever, and then you can attend to your attentiveness. Mm-hmm. That's the second. That's what he's talking about. So, okay. Right up to this point. Clear? So cognitional acts, then, that's what he's concerned with. So that's what we will be dealing with, because that's what he's very leading to in this chapter. They differ in kind, and so does the awareness immanent in different kinds of acts. The way I write about this is that just think of the difference between your self-experience, the self-taste, if you want. That's a Hopkins phrase, but Lonergan uses it in one of his later articles to talk about precisely what he's talking about here. When you're confused and when you've had an insight that pulls things together, there's a real difference there. Or when you're weighing the evidence and you say, I'm not sure about this. And then when the evidence is in and you assent. When you're trying to make a decision about what you're going to do, and then when you've made one that lets you be in peace, there's a difference there. So there's the awareness immanent in the different kinds of acts is different. So there's an empirical consciousness that is characteristic of sensing, perceiving, and imagining. So again, what he's doing here is simply laying out the levels of consciousness, which we've already seen in chapter 9 on judgment. We had that little graph on that page there. But now the first level of consciousness is referred to as empirical consciousness. That is sensing, perceiving, imagining. That's the three words that he uses here. In the paper that I wrote for the Lonergan workshop this summer, I am suggesting that we name this a level of reception. A level at which we simply receive data. Whether the data be sense, or whether it could even be things like the words of someone else. Where to receive them involves a certain verstehen, a certain understanding, but not in the sense of an original act of insight. Anyway, that's complicating it a little bit, but I think ultimately that has to be brought into empirical consciousness. I'll take this out for the moment, though, because what he's saying at this point is empirical consciousness is characterized by such things as acts of sensing, perceiving, imagining. As the content of these acts is merely presented or represented, so the awareness immanent in the acts is the mere givenness. Of the act. But there is an intelligent consciousness. Sometimes, if you're in the summertime and it's a hot day and you're just lying on a beach and watching the clouds go by, you're in empirical consciousness. But if something arouses a question in you, intelligent consciousness begins. Inquiry. Insight, formulation. Inquiry leads to insight, insight to conceptualization, formulation, words. On this level, cognitional process not merely strives for and reaches the intelligible, but in doing so, it exhibits its intelligence. It operates intelligently, and it's a different self-presence. You're present to yourself as an intelligent being. Different self-presence. The awareness is present, but it is the awareness of intelligence, of what strives to understand, of what is satisfied by understanding, of what formulates the understood. Finally, on the third level of reflection, grasp of the unconditioned and judgment, there is rational consciousness. That's his That's the way. What he means by rational consciousness is the level of reflection and judgment. Grasp of the unconditioned and judgment. So there are three levels of consciousness. It is the emergence and the effective operation of a single law of utmost generality, the law of sufficient reason. In other words, I don't judge unless I grasp that I've got a sufficient reason to judge. Where the sufficient reason is the unconditioned. It emerges as a demand for the unconditioned, a refusal to assent unreservedly on any lesser ground. You can withhold judgment. And if you haven't got the evidence, as John said last week, then the only reasonable thing to do is to withhold judgment. It advances to grasp of the unconditioned. It terminates in the rational compulsion by which grasp of the unconditioned commands assent. So there are the three levels then of self-presence. Probably the cat only has that level of self-presence, empirical consciousness. There is not a lot of evidence that the cat makes reasonable judgments based on the grasp of sufficient evidence. So intelligent consciousness, rational consciousness, that's our consciousness. On the second level, intelligence and intelligibility, subject and object. Intelligence is subject, intelligibility characterizes the object. Are the obverse and reverse of the second level of knowing. Intelligence looks for intelligible patterns in presentations and representations. So I want form, I want meaning. That's what he means by intelligible patterns. It grasps such patterns in its moments of insight. It exploits such grasp in its formulations and in further operations equally guided by insight. So I do have conscious states and conscious acts that are intelligent. And that's all that is claimed here. Intelligence pertains to the proceeding of my consciousness. It's one of its characteristics. I want to understand. I do. I want to grasp intelligible unities and relations. I want to know what's up. I want to know where I stand. Human relationships, I want to know where I stand. I want to know what's up. That's a desire for intelligibility. What's going on? Praise of the scientific spirit that inquires, that masters, that controls, is not without an echo, a deep resonance within me, even if I'm not a scientist. But I admire that. Because in my more modest way, I too inquire and catch on, see the thing to do, and see that it's properly done. But what are these but variations on the more basic expression that I am intelligently conscious? That the awareness characteristic of cognitional acts on the second level is an active contributing to the intelligibility of its products, and that this goes on in me. And on the third level, reasonableness and groundedness. Subject, reasonableness, groundedness, object. The obverse and reverse of the third level of knowing. Reasonableness is reflection in as much as it seeks groundedness for objects of thought. Reasonableness discovers groundedness in its reflective grasp of the unconditioned. Reasonableness exploits groundedness when it affirms objects because they are grounded. So reasonableness, too, pertains to the proceeding of my consciousness. It is repugnant to me, unless I'm writing fiction, of course, but otherwise, to place astrology and astronomy, alchemy and chemistry, legend and history, hypothesis and fact, on exactly the same footing. I can explore astrology, I can explore alchemy, but it's not, doesn't have the same status as astronomy and chemistry. I'm not content with theorems, however brilliantly coherent, but I insist on raising the further question, are they true? What is that repugnance, that discontent, that insistence? Just so many variations on the more basic expression that I am rationally conscious. I demand sufficient evidence, sufficient reason. That I find it in the unconditioned, that I assent unreservedly to nothing else. That such demanding, finding, self-committing occur not like the growth of my hair, which happens without any awareness, at least mine now, but within a field of consciousness for awareness. So it's an awareness there. I know that, or I'm aware of needing, wanting, demanding sufficient reason before I will assent to something. So that it's different. Okay. Now, all of these acts occur within a single field of consciousness. So it's me, the unity identity whole that I mean by when I say I. It's a single field. It's not like I'm empirically conscious and Chris is intelligently conscious and Cora is reasonably conscious. It's each one of us is all through. Single field of consciousness. So to talk about a single field of consciousness and draw a distinction between conscious acts occurring within the field and unconscious acts occurring outside it, like the metabolism of my cells, is to affirm a unity of consciousness despite a multiplicity of acts. There are many acts that coalesce into a single knowing. Not only is the percept inquired about, understood, formulated, reflected on, grasped as unconditioned and affirmed, that's the object of it, but also there's an identity involved. I am doing all these. I'm perceiving, inquiring, understanding, formulating, reflecting, grasping, and unconditioned and affirming. These are all activities where the subject is I. I do this. I do that. The identity that he's talking about. And in fact, consciousness, the self-presence, is much more of that unity in the diverse acts than it is of the diverse acts. It's the unity, it's I, it's the conscious I. Okay? For it's within the unity that the acts are found and distinguished. And it's to the unity that we appeal when we talk about a single field of consciousness. Not only do the contents of the acts coalesce into unities, but also many acts coalesce into a single knowing, which is completed when I reach the judgment, one single increment. This unity of consciousness is given, not something that I have to say, that I have to deduce to. It's given. Each of us is aware of ourselves in this unity, a single agent involved in many acts. It's an abstraction to speak of the acts as conscious because concretely consciousness pertains to the acting agent in all of his or her many acts. Okay. This account of consciousness is not itself consciousness. Consciousness goes on without anybody being able, even if you couldn't give an account of it. Walk up to the person on the street and say, what is the difference between consciousness and knowing? Well, they'll just look at you. But they are conscious. They view as conscious. And their feelings of what an idiot this is. So the account of consciousness is not itself consciousness. I had the experience over in the Manual Life Center a number of months ago. I was sure that the person who was sitting having coffee from behind was Danny Mansour, who works with us at the Library Research Institute. And I almost walked up behind this person and said, and have you had any thoughts recently on the four-point theological hypothesis, which is something that Danny and I... And then I got up there and I realized it's not here. And I would have thought I was an absolute nut. So, this account of consciousness is not itself consciousness. Consciousness is given independently of its being formulated or affirmed. And it's here in this rudimentary state that one finds the experiential fulfillment of the conditions for the judgment of self-affirmation. Just as in science there is reversal to what is given sensibly, so here there is reversal to what is just given consciously. Just as the former reversal, scientific reversal, is away from the understood as understood, the formulated as formulated, the affirmed as affirmed, and back to the merely sensed, and that's where you find the evidence for your judgments. So also the latter reversal, the self-knowledge, is from the understood, formulated, affirmed as such to the merely given, where I find the conditions for the affirmation, the judgment. The conditions as formulated are unity, identity, whole, grasp the data as individual, and all these acts. But the fulfillment of the conditions in consciousness is simply in experience. It's not a matter of having formulated all of this. It's just a matter of self-presence in these different activities. So do I do this? Do I do that? Do I do this? The The fulfillment of the conditions is to be had by reverting from such formulations to the more rudimentary state of the formulated, where there's no formulation, but merely experience. In section 5, if you've got the book, I didn't point it because it's the whole section. If you don't have it, just follow along, or maybe perhaps look on someone else. But section 5 in the chapter is page, where is it? 352-353. So this is what he means by saying, by reverting to that more rudimentary state. And it's section 5 that is the section in which he hopes that you will make the judgment that he's asking you to make in this chapter. From preliminary clarifications, then, we turn to the issue, am I a knower? Each one has to ask the question of himself or herself, but anyone who asks it is rationally conscious. For the question is a question for reflection, a question to be met with a yes or no. And asking the question does not mean repeating the words, but entering the dynamic state in which dissatisfaction with mere theory manifests itself in a demand for fact. What is so? Further, the question is not any question. If I ask it, I know what it means. So in rational consciousness, the very fact that the question is asked is an act of rational consciousness. But I know what the question means, and that's a second level meaning. I know what it means. What do I mean by I? Well, it might be difficult to formulate an answer, but strangely, in some obscure fashion, I know very well what it means without formulation. By that obscure yet familiar awareness, I find fault with various formulations of what is meant by I. But I have this at least vague awareness of what that word means. In other words, I has a rudimentary meaning from consciousness. And it envisages neither the multiplicity nor the diversity of contents and conscious acts, but rather the unity that goes along with them. But if I has some such rudimentary meaning from consciousness, then consciousness supplies the fulfillment of one element in the conditions for affirming that I am a knower. So there's an I that's given. There's a unity that's given in consciousness. That's the first thing that he's affirming. Does consciousness supply the fulfillment for the other conditions? Well, do I see or am I blind? Do I hear or am I deaf? Do I try to understand, or is the distinction between intelligence and stupidity no more applicable to me than to a stone? Have I any experience of insight, or is the story of Archimedes as strange to me as the account of Plotinus' vision of the One? Do I conceive, think, consider, suppose, define, formulate, or is my talking like the talking of a parrot? I reflect. I ask whether I am a knower. Do I grasp the unconditioned? If not in other instances, then at least in this one. If I grasp the unconditioned, would I not be under the rational compulsion of affirming that I am a knower? And so either affirm it or else find some loophole, some weakness, some incoherence in this account of the genesis of self-affirmation. As each has to ask these questions of him or herself, so too each has to answer them for him or herself. But the fact of the answer, asking, and the possibility of the answering are themselves a sufficient reason for the affirmative answer. The very fact that I can ask those questions and answer them is all I need. Because all he's asking you to affirm is that these things go on in me. That's all. They do happen. And I am, there's that rudimentary sense of the unity. Okay, so that you can understand something and I don't understand it yet. All right? So there's an understanding that's taking place, but it's not mine, it's yours. That's, there's the you, a unity identity whole that's you that understands. You, and I don't yet, okay, but I'm trying to. Unity identity whole, so I'm striving to understand. So, there is that awareness of the I as opposed to anyone else, and that these activities go on in me, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, inquiring, having occasional insights, formulating my insights, testing them, reflecting, weighing the evidence, judging. And that's what he's asking you to do. And so then he goes on and does some more stuff with that judgment, self-affirmation as imminent law, section 6. We'll probably take this and then we'll take our break, because when we come back I want to read a number of paragraphs from the book. And I couldn't get through them all before the break. So the section 6 on self-affirmation as imminent law explores, so it's section 5 that is where the self-affirmation is meant to be made. It's not, the rest of it is logical unpacking of that judgment. He does not want you to reach the judgment as a result of the logical unpacking. He wants you to have reached it already before that by finding the evidence in your own consciousness, in your own self-presence, that these things go on in me and that I am the same identity that senses this desk is able, at least, to understand it physically from the standpoint of physical science. It's the same I that is going on, that is involved. So section 6 is the first section where he does a logical unpacking of the same judgment. He explores the performative consistency of the answer yes to the question, am I a knower? And the performative contradiction to a negative answer to the same question. So first of all, the consistency of yes. There is a conditional necessity to the affirmative answer. The answer yes to the question, am I a knower, is coherent. It's a coherent answer. For if I'm a knower, I can know that fact. Well, the answer no is incoherent. For if I'm not a knower, how could the question be raised and answered by me? So again, it's logically incoherent to say I am not a knower. And the answer, I don't know, is also incoherent, for if I know that I don't know, then I'm a knower. I know something. If I don't know that I don't know, then I shouldn't answer the question at all. Moreover, if I'm not a knower, then I know nothing. If I know nothing, then I should just shut up. My only course is silence. The complete silence of the animal is complacently absorbed in merely sensitive routines, empirical consciousness, without excuses. Know nothing, I know no excuses for not knowing. I cannot know the explanation of my ignorance. Okay, now that's a logical unpacking, but that is not the argument. The argument is simply discover this, section 5. But then he does a number of different logical takes on it and builds up the logical coherence and the logical consistency. Now I don't really want to do this next thing until we come back. Let me pause and see where we're at in terms of questions, observations, judgments.
I had a question, and I'm trying to remember whether we've covered this before. So, when he's talking about reasonableness and the judgment of fact, is that a question? Is that just the question of is it true,
yes,
or it could also be questions like is it good?
Okay, it's a matter of language. He will use reasonableness for questions of fact, and responsibility for questions of good. So it's just in order to, responsibility adds a fourth level. There's a number of different terminologies that he uses for it. Existential consciousness, where the question of is it worthwhile, is it good, or what am I to do, what is the right thing to do, comes up at that level. And that's different from this level, and your experience is different. Your self-presence is different when you're trying to make a decision about what's good from your self-presence as simply affirming fact. So rational, existential consciousness is concerned with value. So in his language, be attentive, be intelligent, be reasonable. Reasonableness is here, be responsible is there. So reasonableness, responsibility. But that's a use of language. You can reasonably use the word reasonable to for the other. It's just that, that he's got a specific meaning for it, to distinguish it at one level from, to distinguish the levels.
Another question. If, let's say, that it is a question of aesthetics,
right.
Let's say, is it something that is pleasing?
That's right.
What about that?
Okay, good question, because he doesn't do a lot with that matter. And I think that that's a question that he's left for others to place in relationship to the things that he's worked out. There's the whole issue of the transcendentals as inherited from the medievals. Because you've got the transcendentals of the intelligible, the true and the real and the good are connected with these three levels of consciousness. But you've also got the transcendental of the beauty, of the beautiful, which in some medieval thinkers, and at times it's in Aquinas, but would be more, I think, in some of the others. Now, where does that fit in this whole thing? And I'm still trying to work that out myself, but it has to be done. Well, I think it, theologically that there's a need for complementing Lonergan with some of the emphases of von Balthasar, because you have when there's an emphasis on aesthetics and von Balthasar. I don't agree with completely with everything von Balthasar writes, but I do agree that there's an aesthetic and a dramatic quality to theology that has been abandoned in the course of scholastic theology that must be retrieved, and I think he's absolutely right about that. But where it fits into the kind of the schema of consciousness, there I've tried many. I've tried a number of different things, and I'm not completely satisfied with any of them.
You're not going to talk about them right now.
I'm not prepared to.
Okay.
I could work something out.
It's been not easy.
Yeah. Is it anything around beauty as the splendor of truth?
Yeah, that's one of the
things. But another. Component of whatever splendor, easy, dramatic.
One of Thomas's one of Thomas Aquinas's definitions of beauty is splendor veritatis, which it happens is the title that he used for the encyclical. But he's not referring there at all to Thomas, and he never doesn't refer to beauty or anything like that. I asked our moral theologians about it, and they said no. But that is one of Thomas's definitions of beauty. And in that sense, then, what beauty is it's sort of feeding back to the empirical level the integrity and harmony of the intelligible, the true, and the good. You know? And so it's in some ways, it's the wrapping up of it all for us. The only problem with some of this is that what about if there are angels, which I believe there are, well, do they not have some kind of awareness of beauty? And if it comes back to the empirical consciousness of a human being, then there's a problem with that notion.
What if it also included the data of consciousness, which they would have?
Yeah, they would have data of consciousness.
And so their data of consciousness would be the beatific vision.
For von Balthasar, beauty is the analog for divine glory. So our way into some kind of understanding of the glory of God is through created beauty. And so with an angelic consciousness, there would be an immediate presence to the glory of God. It would not be seeing the light, you know. It wouldn't be, because they don't have eyes to see. We don't know what it would be. We don't know, because we're not pure spirit. So that raises a lot of questions. What do you do with the notion of immunity? I don't have it completely. Psychic conversion, I think, has something to do with it, what I've called psychic conversion. But there is that difficulty about, Joe Kamanchak put it to me, because I tried to use psychic conversion as a basis for the transcendental of the beautiful. And he said, well, you know, angels don't have any sensitive psyches. So what do you do with their experience of the beautiful? They must have it. Spent that much time thinking about angels. great for him. Good question.
Okay, you want to say that?